Hello, welcome to the Beatles Books podcast with me, Joe Wisby. I'm welcoming Mark Lewison back to the pod today, and this time he's here to discuss some of his favourite Beatles books. From Hunter Davies to Michael Brown, from Derek Taylor to Richard DiLello, Mark tells us the stories behind some of the most famous books in Beatle literature. Mark Lewison, hello, welcome back to the Beatles Books podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
We're going to spend some time talking today about Beatles books, which is a subject which hopefully between the two of us, we can offer some insight and intrigue on.
Yes.
And we're going to start by talking about generally seen to be the first Beatles book. You can correct us if it isn't. Love Me Do by Michael Braun. My first question is, how common would a book in this style be in the early 60s about a pop group? Were there similar styles of books?
No, definitely not. There were pocket paperbacks on popular music. There was a Cliff one. I think it's called It's Great to Be Young or It's Wonderful to Be Young, something like that. I've got it in my library. And there was some about trad jazz. I don't recall. There may have been one on Elvis. I don't have it and haven't seen one, but it's possible there was. But generally speaking, no, this was completely uncommon. And it was a first in many respects, and certainly an unusual book to be published at the time, because it was bought really by Beatles fans, and yet it wasn't the stuff that fan books are usually made from.
What's the story of it? How did it kind of come about? Was it always going to be something that the Beatles were going to be involved in at this point?
Yeah, well, I've actually done exhaustive research into this for writing about him in the second volume of my trilogy, because it's an important piece and his interactions with them were important. And the way the book took shape and how it was edited and everything is actually quite important as a Beatles story. Mm. His name, incidentally, is Brown. It looks like Braun, but it's Michael Brown, though it looks like Braun. And he was a New Yorker. A young Jewish New Yorker, an interesting, quite intense young man who was in England anyway at the time of the immense breakthrough of the Beatles in terms of popular press, autumn of 1963. And he proposed to Brian Epstein that he be allowed to be with the Beatles for a bit for some unspecified purpose. As far as I can make out, I don't believe a book was envisaged at the beginning. He was allowed to hang out with them with no contract. It was just like, well, OK, you know, you can, like in those days and probably less to an extent now, but where everything is so micromanaged. But you could just allow someone to just be with you for a while and they would observe and maybe write an article or something like that. But I think the longer he was with them, the more he decided it actually had the makings of a book. There are gaps in the knowledge, but as far as I can tell, he actually approached Tom Mashler, who was the editorial director at Jonathan Cape. Mashler gave him the green light to consider this as the fodder for a book rather than as a journalistic article. And indeed, it was Brown who took John Lennon's writings to Tom Mashler and said, what do you think of this? I think initially he didn't say who they were by. I just wanted to see what Mashler's reaction would be. And Mashler liked John's work very much and said, I would publish this. And Brown said, well, it's by John Lennon of the Beatles. So he was the conduit to John Lennon writing those books, or at least getting Jonathan Cape to publish them. But in the end, Jonathan Cape didn't publish Michael Brown's book. I interviewed Mashler three times about it. Once he said there was no contract and twice he said there was. But in the Jonathan Cape archives, which I've been through, there's no indication that there was a contract. So I'm a bit in the dark about certain aspects. But he did have a literary agent called Mike Clowes, who I interviewed at length about Mike Brown. And he gave me a good lowdown on how that book then progressed to publication. And although Jonathan Cape had initiated it, they didn't publish it, and it was published by Penguin. And the Beatles were happy to have Michael Brown around. He wasn't around them as much as the book indicates. In fact, I've done a complete analysis of the book, and really he was around them only 7, 8, 9 times, something like that. In the end, he outstayed his welcome. And by the time they got to Paris, he was no longer allowed in the room. He doesn't tell you that. In fact, that is, the book is an honest book, except in the respect that Brown doesn't say what actually happened to him, which would, I think, would have made good copy for the book, because they basically shut him out of the room, and he couldn't get in any more after that. Anybody in that position can do it, but the Beatles were always very good. If you were well, you were welcome until they didn't want you anymore, and then you were most unwelcome. Judy Martin told me that she was in Paris with George and the Beatles, and she said, "What happened to that?" I'm not going to do an impression of Judy. What happened to Mike Brown? He was a nice young man, a bit intense, but suddenly in Paris they were shutting every door in his face. And if you read the book, it actually does tail off by the time they get to it. He writes as if he's there in the room, but actually it's all secondhand, probably via Brian Somerville, the Beatles press agent. I wish he had written it. I think that would have been interesting how he was suddenly non grata. In fact, Paul McCartney's book of photographs that was published in 23 had two pictures of Mike Brown. And the captions just say, "This is Mike Brown who wrote a book about us," which wholly inadequate as captions, because there's a proper story there. Particularly the picture of Mike Brown on the plane flying to America on the 7th of February 64. He's on the Pan Am flight with them, but he's not with them. And Paul McCartney stuck his camera, obviously opened the curtain a little bit, separating first class with economy class, and took a photograph of Mike Brown sitting there. I can't remember exactly what the caption is, but it's a nothing caption except to say his name. But in reality, Brown had been frozen out by then, and Paul is taking a picture of a journalist who is hoping to re-ingratiate himself and failing. There's much more interesting caption to be done about that picture than Paul remembered. So I'm going to tell it. I'm going to tell that story. And it's a really, really good story. Now, the book is quite candid. That's what makes it so interesting, because it's remarkably candid. And when it came out, although John Lennon had got tired of Michael Brown, he liked the book because it was quite honest. It had the Beatles swearing, for example. And pop stars were not known to swear then. And if they did swear, they would say, "Don't use that." Or the journalists would know simply not to use it. But Mike Brown did quote them swearing. And there were pieces, there was a piece or a couple of lines in the NME about, the Beatles are quoted swearing in Michael Brown's book. And that caused problems for Penguin, because a lot of parents bought that book for their children for Christmas. And then sometimes before their children read it, but sometimes after their children read it, they would open it up and see that this book was inappropriate for their sons or daughters to read at a juvenile age. And there were letters of complaint to Penguin about it. And in the end, despite the hugeness of the Beatles in America, and hugeness doesn't begin to describe how big the Beatles were, no American publisher took that book.
Wow.
All this is very, very interesting sociologically. And I'm going to be right. I've done a lot of work on it, and I'm going to be writing about it. But I was honored to be invited to write a new foreword for it at the time of the anthology. Penguin, quite astute of Penguin, because I mean, I'd done some books on the Beatles, didn't have the reputation then that I have now. But the editor got in touch and said, "We're going to republish it. We've got the rights still. Would you like to write a foreword setting it in its context?" And I did. I did just that in 95.
I think the talking about the language, the line that stood out for me is there's a bit in it when they're told that girls masturbate while they're on stage. And I think Paul says, "We're still at the masturbating stage ourselves."
Yes, indeed. He does say that. There's also a quote in there, "We've always hated Cliff Richard." It might say it is funny. And these days, such an outspokenness is really not so uncommon, but it really was uncommon then. It really was. These things, if they were said at all, were said privately. They weren't said for publication. But I found the details and the date of when Brian Epstein read it as a manuscript. And the intriguing thing is, he didn't change any of those things. I think this is very interesting.
Yes. John mentions it in the Rolling Stone interview. Is that where he says it? A true book. He wrote How We Were, which was Bastard. So it must have stayed with John.
It came up in the Jan Wenner interview in the context of the Hunter Davis book, because Jan Wenner mentioned something, such and such a thing, in the Hunter Davis book, and John jumps in by saying it was bullshit, which of course it wasn't, but John was in a very particular mood that day. And for comparison, he said the Mike Brown book was the one. But I don't suppose he had reread it in between 64 and 70.
No.
But it is a good book. It really is a good book. It's a very useful resource for me, both in terms of its content as I say, the story of its writing is very interesting.
Do you remember at the time, you said it didn't get a release in America, but in this country, was it something that every Beatle fan had over the course of that kind of 65, 66 period?
No, it didn't sell. Actually, it did come out in America, but not as a book. It came out as a one-shot magazine. And it didn't sell very well either. I've compared it to the book to see how it got changed, because references to masturbation and things like that were definitely cut for the American audience. But making it a one-shot was really aiming it at kids. Whereas the Penguin book was a proper little Penguin paperback, not necessarily aimed at kids. But a lot of Beatle fans did buy it, but not as many as you would think. It just kind of slipped out and slipped away. Considering how huge the Beatles were in 64, it didn't make the splash that one might imagine it did. But then again, its content was far from juvenile, and that somehow or other that must have come across.
It's fascinating because if you think John's books came out 64, 65, and they, you know, they really weren't aimed at a juvenile audience. That was they're not easy to digest and read. But they sold, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I'm guessing they sold in huge numbers at the time, even if they weren't looked at much beyond maybe those initial first times that the readers would look at them. Yeah. It's fascinating why this didn't cut through.
There wasn't a lot of marketing for it. It got well reviewed in the Sunday papers, you know, by the literary editors, but not much mentioned in the juvenile press and in the music papers. So quite a few fans would have been unaware of it. In those days, there were so few books on popular music that there were no sections in bookshops devoted to them. So you wouldn't necessarily find it very easily, even if you were looking for it. And not every bookshop in those days, I think I'm right in saying, not every bookshop sold Penguin paperbacks. There were certain shops that sold them, but not every shop. Sometimes there'd be in a little turntable rack that you could spin around. I was only a child. I wasn't looking for it. I certainly didn't see it when I was a child. In a sense, I was a potential purchaser, but I was unaware of it until I read the Lennon Remembers book.
I was going to say, was it around through the 70s? If this version was 95, was it something that you could pick up easily through the 70s and 80s still? Was it
No, not at all. It went out of print. There used to be older listeners, people my age, may remember a London pop music bookshop on Shaftesbury Avenue called Musique Boutique, which was up a couple of flights of stairs in one of those old buildings on Shaftesbury Avenue in London, in the centre of London. And they sold, it was a specialist music retailer, some sheet music and folios, but also books about pop and rock. And there were beginning to be a few by then. And he negotiated to get the rights to republish it. But I think he only sold it in his own shop, and there aren't many of those around. But eventually it came out again in 95, and then it came out again, because I've got another edition here, 2019. It's probably available now. But no, there were many years in which it was hard to find. It's a very quick and easy read, and a very valuable book. I love the fact that it happened. It stuck out. For those who knew it, it stuck out.
Absolutely. So from Love Me Do, we will move on to Hunter Davies, The Beatles, the Authorised Biography. So this is sort of, maybe apart from a few exceptions, the only ever authorised biography of the Beatles, and probably will remain that way. Tell us a little bit about Hunter, how this book kind of came together.
Hunter is from Carlisle, I think I'm right in saying, certainly grew up in Carlisle. And he was a journalist and writer. By 1966, he was down in London. The north of England did produce a lot of talent that rose to the surface in London and rose to the surface in the 60s and typically came to London to do it. And Hunter wrote Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush, which was made into a film. He had money, had a book contract with Heinemann, and he was writing for the Sunday Times. In fact, I think the Atticus column, which was quite a pioneering investigative journalism column that ran every week in the Sunday Times in those days, was his baby for a while, sometimes with a byline, but often without, but nonetheless, it was usually him. in that context, he asked for and got an interview with Paul McCartney, which happened in September 66. And he went to, I think, Cavendish Avenue to interview Paul at home, either at that time or very soon after, came up with the idea of writing a book about the Beatles. There'd been Mike Brown's, there'd been one or two others in America, there'd been one or two. There was one that we haven't mentioned yet, which was The True Story of the Beatles, which Beatles Monthly magazine published as a standalone paperback, with a pseudonymous author of Billy Sheppard, who was really Peter Jones of Record Mirror. But there hadn't really been a weighty book that attempted to tell their story. And Hunter's argument was, do it now before you forget it. This is the end of 66. You've already been big 63, 4, 5, and 6. There's a lot's happened in these 4 years. I think you're worthy of a book of this magnitude, and would you do it? And Paul liked the idea and said, fine by me, but you have to get Brian to approve it and the others as well. So Hunter wrote a letter to Brian on December the 31st, 1966, proposing just such a book, and eventually meets Brian. And I've got the date. It was the 26th of January he met Brian, and it was okay by Brian. I think they could see. I think Hunter's timing was perfect in ways that he couldn't possibly have appreciated at the time. But certainly when you look at the Beatles from history, that period of 63, 4, 5, 6, although you can break it down into many sections, in essence, it's part one of their two-part career as huge stars in the moment. Their whole story has many, many parts, but 63, 4, 5, 6 is that Beatlemania period where they're touring and they're making films and so on. And then 67 onwards is something else. And I think they were aware that they were changing. They were changing physically in their appearance, they were changing musically, and they were stopping going on the road. So I think Paul could probably see that, well, actually, if we're going to do it, this is quite a good opportunity to tell that part of the story because the next part is going to be different. And Brian may have seen it the same way. And the others came on board as well. Paul was the one who pushed it, but he didn't push it that hard. It was up to Hunter to persuade Brian and to persuade the others, and they all went for it. So in early 67, he started to do his research, which began, I think he got some names and addresses from them of people he needs to go and see. And then he went on the road and interviewed the parents. He went up to interview Jim McCartney and Ringo's mum and Harry Graves and Harry and Louise Harrison and Aunt Mimi, and eventually even got to Ringo's real father and then John Lennon's real father. And for me, that book has great value in many respects, but one particular respect is it's the only time the parents really spoke at any length about these guys when they were in their formative years. The parents generally didn't give interviews. There's a couple of exceptions to that, but generally they didn't. The key thing was each of the Beatles in turn said to his parent, or in John's case, his aunt, you can speak to him. It's okay. Normally they would say, I've had an approach from so-and-so, can I? And Paul would say, or George would say, or Ringo or John would say, don't. But this time they said, no, you can. And so he went up and he got really invaluable stuff from the parents, which without Hunter, we just wouldn't know it. His book has great many strengths, has a few weaknesses as well, but it has a great many strengths. And without that book, there will be a very considerable gap in our knowledge. So it was brilliant that he did it.
Why do you think Hunter was the right person to write this kind of book? Because you say clearly he got to these people and they opened up. Did you get a sense either from the time that you've spent with him of why he was the right kind of writer for this kind of book?
Because he wasn't old, he was still a young man, about 30 when he's doing this. He was from the North and he was from the Sunday Times. And he had all the, tick, 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 basically, because the Sunday Times was intelligent, intellectual, but without being too pretentious. It was just a very good newspaper. It wasn't yet allied to the Times, actually, it was an independent publication. And as I say, the timing. So, and he's easy to talk to. And he didn't record anything, which I think can be a daunting prospect, especially for people unfamiliar with having their voice recorded, especially in those days. We're much more familiar and comfortable now with hearing our voices. But when someone would hear their voice recorded, they would go, oh, is that what I sound like? And I think the Beatle parents would have probably been shy of a tape recorder, but he didn't use them. He used little pocket notebooks and wrote in a scribble that only he could read, and sometimes not even him. He's donating them now, or has donated them to the British Library, his notebooks. I've been through them. They are almost illegible. I mean, they are really, I'm saying, what does that say, Hunt? Because I went through them with Hunter years ago. Don't know what they say, but it's your writing. Yeah, I don't know what it says. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure what value to the nation those notebooks are going to be, but I'm glad he's donated them nonetheless. Perhaps that could be a project for someone to try and work out what he said.
One of the things I noticed about the book when I reread it recently is it doesn't talk a lot about the music. Why do you think that was?
Well, the first reason would have to be, and I think Hunter would say this, it was secondary importance as in his interests. He was interested in them as people. He was interested in how all this had happened. As a newspaper man, the story of the Beatles' breakthrough and how things evolved interested him greatly. And he was very interested in their backgrounds, council houses and grammar schools and such like. He wasn't that interested or knowledgeable about the music, and barely wrote about it, except when the book becomes contemporary, when he is hanging around them in March, April 67, much in the way that Mike Brown was invited to hang out with the Beatles. Just come and, just come and sit there. If don't even talk if you don't want to, or we won't want you to talk necessarily, but you can come and just sit there if you like. And I mean, I had that experience myself with Paul in later years, once or twice, where you could just be there. So, and his being there happened to be when they're making Sergeant Pepper. So the book is very strong, and really invaluable when it comes to the insight of some of the writing sessions for Pepper and one or two of the recording sessions, but particularly the writing sessions in Paul's house. He didn't bother that much with the music, really, and gone on before then. He wrote about the songs, but only in terms of, She Loves You came out and it made a huge impact. But he doesn't write about what made She Loves You so special, why it sounded like nothing had ever sounded before, how they wrote it, how they recorded it. These details were unimportant to Hunter. And that's okay because he was writing this kind of book, but it left space for those who would write others. Philip Norman, when he wrote Shout, and actually there's only 13 years between them in terms of publication, he also didn't look at the music. And when it was pointed out to him, Philip Norman, that he hadn't really mentioned the music, he did an updated edition in which he tried to mention the music a bit more, but it was still very much not his thing, you could tell. It's funny, isn't it? But it's an interesting insight into the mind of a journalist at that time that the music was secondary to the story.
Obviously, Hunter spent time with all four individual Beatles. Do you think that either from what you've read in the book, the conversation you've had with Hunter, do you think that he understood the four of them individually equally? Do you think he had different connections with the different Beatles?
Yes, he would have done. He had what it's generally the common experience, although nothing is ever absolute in this story, because you get people who warm to any one of them for particular reasons. But I'll say this about Hunter's book, and this is not a criticism, but it is very much, I think, an accurate observation. And that is that he and Philip Norman, they have this in common, Sunday Times, both journalists. And the book is essentially a string of journalistic articles, in as much as he would go and interview Jim Mack for a day. An interview, go and sit with Jim Mack and ask him some questions and scribble in his notebook. While it was still fresh, he'd do what journalists ought to do, which is you go home and type it. And that chapter would be done, typed within a handful of days of him going up there to meet Jim. And then it's done. Put that chapter, done that chapter now, file it. And then he'll go to John at Weybridge and, hang out with John for a few hours. Go back, type it, that chapter is done. And it is, in essence, therefore, that book is a sequence of individual chapters, each of which is very strong in itself. But there isn't really the narrative thread quite so much, because he's not written it as a book. He's written it like a journalist, which is a lot of articles. This is not criticism. This is not criticism at all. And indeed, I might be wrong, and it's only my point of view, but this is how I see the book. And Shout is a bit more of a narrative, has a bit more of a narrative thread. So when it came to Hunter, he saw Ringo a handful of times all together. Hello, Ringo. Hi, Hunter. Didn't really get close to him. George was in the period of time when he really just wanted to talk about the sitar and India and so on. He had not long come back from the first long trip he made. to Bombay and then to Kashmir. And I think George bored Hunter quite quickly. The book really comes alive with the John and Paul stuff. Most writers gravitated towards John and Paul because they're the sparky ones, Paul particularly, at that time. But like a lot of these people who hung around them, Hunter found John very, very interesting, found Paul very, very interesting as well. And it was ne never a problem to hang around with either of them. And so the book is a little bit of slant towards them. Not much, because he does try to be fair, but he was right. I mean, John and Paul were the driving engine of the Beatles. And the other two guys are very much part of the four, very, very much 25% each of the four. And yet, when you're writing a book, it's John and Paul who have got the interesting stuff.
When Hunter did the John Lennon Letters book
Yeah.
about, what are we, 13, 14 years ago now, I went to a talk, I think at the British Library, but I could be wrong. And he showed what I thought then was some unseen kind of cine camera footage of a holiday that he'd taken with Paul
Yeah.
in Portugal.
Yeah. Out there with his family, and Paul and Linda and Heather arrived.
So clearly there was that. There was a bit of an extra connection with Paul.
I don't know that there was much in the way of fraternization once the book came out. I mean, I'm interested in the process of these things as well as the content, and I have seen some correspondence relating to the writing of the book before it came out where they were miffed with the fact that he was going to be earning so much money off their name, which is a common feeling that they've had since 63 and still feel. So I don't know that they were especially close to him, but there was a bit, probably a bit more of a connection, because Paul was in London, and Paul would take Martha for a walk on sometimes Parliament Hill Fields. Hunter lives very close to there. Once the book came out, they never really mentioned it. And of course, being the Beatles, the book was immediately out of date the moment the ink dried. So it doesn't mention Yoko. And yet, when the book came out, John has split up with Cynthia. She's in this book as John's wife. She wasn't his wife when it came out. Well, she was by law, but by not by relationship. And it's about Paul and Jane, and they'd broken up. So the book was very quickly out of date in that respect. I'm not quite sure how Paul knew that Hunter was in Portugal, but he did know. And he basically did that McCartney thing of knocking on the door saying, "Hi, I'm here. Any way we can stay tonight?" Which is great. And it gave, I don't think Hunter and Margaret, his wife, had met Linda before. So that indicates that they weren't close, because Linda had been around since September of 68, and this was December. In fact, Hunter went to Malta for a while. I think the introduction of the book is signed off in Malta. Derek made a reference to Hunter at that time of H. Davis of Malta. I think it was a tax thing. Like a lot of the socialists, he went out there giving all his money to the government. So, and then he kept in touch with Hunter a little bit. And of course, there was that huge issue that happened in 1985 when the book was republished with a new introduction and some new illustrations from Hunter's collection, in which he quoted Paul. A phone call. Paul was so pissed off with all the pro-Lennon books that came up in the wake of John's assassination that he vented his spleen in some conversation with Hunter, naively not realizing that Hunter, as a journalist, would probably write this down and use it. And Hunter did use it. And J Paul was quoted as saying that John was a maneuvering swine. It's a footnote now, but back in the day in 85, God, this big news. And Paul was really annoyed with Hunter about that, really, really angry.
Do you know
But
why he phoned Hunter? Do you know why he plucked Hunter's name out of that phone book that day? Obviously you can't say for certain, but do you have any idea as to why he might pick up the phone to Hunter that day?
no, I can't remember. I've got an interview with Hunter in which I asked him about it. They weren't regularly in the habit of phoning one another. No, it was a reason. Or maybe he just wanted to vent his spleen to someone who had known John and was likely to be a sympathetic ear. But as Hunter said, I mean, he was talking to a journalist. What did he think I was going to do with it? He certainly used it without Paul knowing he was going to use it. And when it hit the headlines, and it really did hit the headlines for a while globally, Paul was not happy.
So you mentioned Love Me Do was difficult to find to a certain extent through the 60s. Was this a much bigger commercial hit? Was this something that, do you remember much about this coming out at the time? What was the initial impact of the book?
I didn't get it because I was only a child, but I got it from the library. And I had it often on loan from the library. It went into probably every public library in the UK, maybe in the US, maybe in most countries. It got translated into many, many languages. The paperback, funnily enough, barely did anything, but its key audience was that first hardback edition, and it spread internationally. And it informed everybody about the Beatles' formative years. Mostly correctly and sometimes a little bit incorrectly, but it formed the bedrock of everyone's knowledge, and all authors who came after it used it. It was really a very important work, and it still is. And it still is. And no one can take anything away from Hunter. I mean, other people have taken things away from Hunter, people like me, whose biographies of the Beatles, only one so far, but more to come, are kind of diminishing its importance, but it is important and it should remain important.
Any idea as to why John was a little bit down on it in that Rolling Stone interview?
John was citing, this was what was most unfair about it, looking at it from Hunter's point of view. What happened was Aunt Mimi gave Hunter an interview and said, "I want to read this. You can't print this without letting me see what you're going to say," which was fair enough. You don't necessarily let people see a journalistic article for a newspaper, but in a book where you've got the cooperation of people, you kind of need to respect their requirements. For whatever reason, and I have seen some of the paper trail, and I've been through Hunter's diaries with him, getting all this down, the chronology of the book and how it was written and how things were submitted. Aunt Mimi was bugging John about it. "I still haven't seen it. Make sure I don't want it to come out and say anything that I don't want it to say." And she was getting on John's case about it. And John got onto Hunter saying, "Do the right thing by Mimi," basically. And Hunter did. And he sent it to Mimi. And Mimi took some things out. And John was aware of Mimi expurgating one or two things. They weren't particularly, I mean, it didn't leave the narrative in shreds by any means. It just took out one or two things, which a lot of people would do given the opportunity to review what they've said. But that was uppermost in John's mind, that it had been bowdlerized in that way. And consequently, John took a dim view of the whole book for that little thing that had occurred. And because he said it in that interview, and that interview became a best-selling, well, certainly a very big-selling paperback book through most of the 1970s, and in itself formed opinions about how things were, Hunter's book went down as bullshit, which it really wasn't. John, on another day, or asked a qualifying question by Jan Werner, which he wasn't, might have elaborated, "Oh, well, actually, it was just that bit about Mimi." But the thing about Jan Werner's interview with John, and we may come to this perhaps, I don't know, John just wanted to talk, and Jan Werner led him in certain directions, but John was on fire for various reasons, and venting his spleen. But Jan didn't ask many supplementaries. If he had just gone back to John and said, "Why do you call that Hunter Davis book bullshit? Was it all of it, or was it just a little bit?" And John would have said, "Actually, it was just a little bit." But Jan didn't ask him. So it went down as bullshit, which is most unfair for Hunter, and really unfair on everybody, unfair on Aunt Mimi and everything else about that book. It was just a fairly basic thing she did.
Was Hunter aware of that immediately? Was that something that stayed with him, John's critique?
Yeah, it became a description of his book. Yes, I mean, it hung around it like a bad smell, that description. And I don't know that people know it so much now, but for a long, 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 long time it did. Yeah.
So last time we talked, we spoke about some of your formative Beatle experiences, and we spoke about the book All Together Now, which is a great example of 70s Beatle literature. I want you to just talk a little bit about maybe some of the other books through the 70s, which I think are fascinating in that time that A, there weren't many Beatle books around then, and obviously all four Beatles were with us. So I was curious to get just a little bit of an idea of what kind of book stood out for you between that kind of 70 to 80 period.
There weren't that many. So Hunter's book, although it came out in 68, was still a current book. Don't know when I first saw Mike Brown's book, but There was a little steady trickle of books through the 70s. The difference between books then and books now is that they were done by people who had had an actual involvement in things. They were much more immediate, not only in terms of the events they were describing, although they did seem like history by then. It was only 3, 4, 5 years earlier. But also the participants had the right to say what they were saying. And in some cases, they'd been taking notes and so on. The people who were being interviewed were still young enough to really retain the detail, as opposed to now, where the detail is pretty much gone from the minds of the people who experience things firsthand. Not quite, but almost. Knowing you were going to ask me this, I pulled one, two, three, four. I pulled five books off the shelf
Wonderful.
that were essential reading for anyone who was wanting to know more about the Beatles in that immediate post-breakup period. And the first one is Lennon Remembers, is the Jan Wenner book. Jan Wenner interview with John Lennon and Yoko, but it's principally John, and it's called Lennon Remembers, and it's got a picture of John on the cover. And this really did set the narrative for a very long time, like Hunter's book, for a very, very, very long time, decades. Its impact is diminishing now, but we now have hundreds of books to refer to, and indeed there's the internet. But at a time when there was so little, this book really stood out. And we know a lot about this interview now. In fact, we've now got a recording of pretty much all of this book, not quite all of it, but because I've done an analysis of how much of it we've got, but most of the book is available on audio. And when you listen to it, it comes across less vituperatively, if I can use that word, than the written word does. It really comes across strong on the page, and it's not quite that strong when you listen to it. And in fact, that's true of a lot of Beatles narrative. If you read the book Drugs, Divorce, and a Slipping Image about the January 69 sessions, they had the audio to listen to. But when you see it, here's the difference. When you see it, you realize that things aren't being said as severely as they sound. And probably if we had video of Lennon Remembers, we would see that it wasn't quite as strong as it really did seem on the printed page. It really does come across very strongly. And John Lennon at this time was immediately out of therapy, and it hadn't finished well. When you finish a course of very strong psychotherapy, you really do need to come down gently, have a kind of gentle reintroduction to things, let things settle, all the things that have been raked over in that time. But John didn't. He sat down with a journalist, with an editor of Rolling Stone, and spilled everything, including a lot of stuff that had come up in therapy that he hadn't processed properly and that he might not have said or would have said differently given a bit of an interval of time. This is not in any way to, I'm not apologizing for a word in this or anything. I'm just looking at the facts of when he did it and how he did it. He sat down in, I think, Alan Klein's office. It was December the 8th, 1970, 10 years to the day. And Jan Wenner prodded him a bit, not particularly expertly, but just prodded him a bit, and out tumbled all this stuff. He was angry with Paul because he wanted to be seen as the one who had broken the Beatles up, and it looked like it was Paul. That was uppermost in his mind, along with a few other things. Jan Wenner doesn't have the greatest press these days. He did a great thing with bringing Rolling Stone into print. He earned his place, he earned his stripe. Rolling Stone, hugely important publication. Particularly in those counterculture years in America, from 67 through mid 70s, was that American college generation read it, and it was important politically and important in all sorts of ways, probably in a way that we never quite had in Britain. Very much championing John Lennon and who he was and what he stood for. He didn't ask John Lennon particularly good questions. A lot of this book could have done with supplementary questions. So we have John's saying quite a few negative things about Brian. Along the way, he says Brian was a beautiful guy who presented us well. A supplementary question there would have just elaborated. We could have got something more from John on that. But instead, we get mostly negative. And we get mostly negative about a lot of things that, with a bit of intelligent questioning, might have just elucidated something more balanced. So it comes across very angrily because he's being asked these things and he's just come out of therapy and the Beatles have broken up and he's cross. But we had no other interview with any of them in anything like this length. And therefore, it was a really important book. because it gave us tremendous insight into how the Beatles had happened and why eventually they broke up and what their relationships were like with one another. It was barely touched upon in any other book before this. So a great education, this book, but you really have to read it with all these caveats in mind because they're strongly relevant. But in the 70s, it was essential reading and certainly was read by the authors to come. So again, it really does inform. There is that book about historians of the Beatles,
Yes.
and she makes very plain that this book was set the narrative, which meant that a lot of things were unbalanced after that.
I was lucky enough to do an interview with Joe Hagan that wrote the really excellent book about Rolling Stone. He told me that John was dead against the interview ever being published as a book.
He was.
And that damaged that relationship, didn't it? I think pretty severely.
It was really distressing for John. It was fine. He did it for publication in Rolling Stone, and it was published over two issues, I think I'm right in saying, at the beginning of 71. And if you didn't read Rolling Stone, you really wouldn't have known the interview. And of course, many did read it, but it wasn't that widely circulating. It didn't circulate much in countries outside America. But Jan Wenner had the idea to do it as a book, and John was really against it. And Jan Wenner pushed it through, and John somehow or other was unable to stop it. And years later, this was mid-90s, early 90s, I was doing a project actually that, with my involvement, never came out. I was listening to all of John Lennon's studio tapes with an idea of doing a box set for EMI of the best of the unreleased stuff, all the outtakes. And at the time of Sometime in New York City, they recorded a whispering piece that was going to be laced backwards into a run-out groove of either Sometime in New York City, or if memory serves, an EP that they were or a single they were going to release from it. In the end, it never happened. And they were whispering, "Rolling Stone is a rip-off," just over and over, so that it would be used in that, like the rubbish nonsense at the end of Sergeant Pepper. They were really miffed about it being a book because A, it wasn't. They hadn't given permission. But B, John knew the state of mind he had been in when he did that interview, and that the book was going to make concrete the thoughts that were valid to John at that moment, but weren't necessarily so when he calmed down, or were, just as I've been pointing out, imbalanced in as much as if he'd been asked something positive. He would have said something positive. Yeah, he was really cross about it, but couldn't stop it. Didn't speak to Rolling Stone for a long time after that. And when Jonathan Cott interview him in 1980, first of all, the first thing he did was lay into Jonathan Cott. It wasn't his fault, of course, because he was from Rolling Stone, and John needed to say what he thought about it after all those years. He still hadn't forgotten how angry he was that it became the book, as did the Playboy interview. And I don't think he knew that was going to be a book either.
No.
And this led to that series of books that Omnibus Press did, So and So in Their Own Words. And that's why Paul was so keen to have one out in about 74-5 with the Paul Gambaccini interviews, principally for Rolling Stone, just so that there was a book with him that you could read, all the Q&A.
What else have you got on your top five?
I've got a book that I mention quite often when I'm asked this kind of thing. It's Apple to the Core, by Peter McCabe and Robert Schonfeld. Peter McCabe was English, from the north, from Liverpool, I think, or the Wirral, and was in America. And Schonfeld was a New Yorker. And in the immediate aftermath of the Beatles' breakup and the dissolution, the partnership receivership case in February, March 1971, where a lot of the Beatles' business issues were made public, to an extent, anyway. They realized that as investigative journalists, there was a good story to be told about the Beatles from a business angle. That might sound very dry, but it really isn't. And it absolutely woke me up to the importance of all these characters, not only Brian Epstein, but Nat Weiss and Norman Weiss and Sid Bernstein and Neil Aspinall and Dick James and Geoffrey Ellis and Wendy Hansen, and a body of people whose names I knew a little bit, but or not at all. And they attempted to write. It was one of two books being written at that same time. The second one never came out because this one got the market, I think. And every page of this was an education for me. And McCabe has been gone a long time, but Robert Schonfeld is still alive. And I've known him 10 years now. And in fact, he agreed to my request on a visit I made to New York to go through the book with him and discuss its content and the writing of it to get it down on record because it's such an important piece of work. Paul and the Eastmans wouldn't cooperate, but Klein and John and Yoko did. Now, it doesn't mean that they're in their favor. It's very much an independent, neutral piece of work, but they had some experiences with John that McCabe and Schonfeld in particular, that were really quite riveting, and which I needed to get down on the record. Whether I'll ever do anything with it, I don't know, but I just wanted it to be in an archive somewhere, how this book came to be written. Robert told me that Neil just sat in a room. It was late afternoon, and he didn't put the lights on, so he could barely see Neil while Neil was talking. I'll be taking this book and running with it, and going a lot further and deeper with it. But it's a brilliant book, and it's only a little slim paperback, so it's not difficult to read. Mine is absolutely knackered from having been read and taken on trains and planes. So that's a really important book. Then this one, which is The Longest Cocktail Party by Richard DiLello,
Wonderful book.
which is an absolutely brilliant, brilliant book, and educated the world, or those who were interested in the world, about what life was like on the inside of Apple, particularly in Savile Row. It's a bit skewed in as much as it's really about, primarily about what happens in the press office, because that's where Richard worked. Richard was an American already known to Derek Taylor from Derek's time in LA. And Derek brought a couple of people from LA over with him. Well, not with him, but encouraged people to follow him back to England. And one was Chris O'Dell, and the other one was Richard DiLello. And they knew that if they turned up at Savile Row, they would know Derek, and Derek would find something for them to do and eventually swing whatever, or help to swing whatever permit they might need to stay and work in London. And they both got jobs at Savile Row as a result of Derek. And Richard DiLello quite obviously was a great admirer of Derek, and that's okay because I'm a great admirer of Derek as well. For flavor, you cannot beat this book. It takes you right inside Savile Row in those incredible years, particularly 68 and 69. The book goes on a little bit after that, but that's where it's really strong. And again, it set the narrative. And I know that Paul wasn't entirely happy with the fact that the narrative of Apple was written through that press office prism, because there was more going on in other parts of the building. I mean, it does cover other parts of the building as well, but it is primarily that office and what occurred and the things which was incredible. Of course, that was the longest cocktail party, that office. But because Paul wasn't a great fan of Derek, he doesn't like the fact that Derek is the great hero of this book. I don't think it upsets Paul unduly, but he's mentioned it a couple of times. How I know, because he's mentioned it. But what a book. It just drips authentic flavor and character and personality and detail. And it is a beautiful piece of work, and is a great example of how Derek was an incredible spotter of other people's talent, because he just looked like the house hippie with a big, big afro haircut, sitting either rolling or smoking joints. But he was clearly taking it all in as well. And the book has an incredible immediacy to it, and is very much a formative book when it comes to understanding Apple Corps.
What happened to Richard?
Richard DiLello went on to become a film producer. I've ne never had the pleasure of meeting Richard, but we have corresponded at some length. He had seen the Beatles. He'd seen them on television in the 60s, and he obviously, as a young college student in America in the late 60s, he was very well aware of who they were. And he was also a budding amateur photographer. So he served a purpose within the press office in that there was a man there who could take photographs. And he did take photographs. He took a lot of photographs. He took once he gained their trust, he took pictures of George out of Friar Park. He took pictures of John out at Sittenhurst as well, which were used. He actually did use those pictures for publicity and so on. And he went on to have a long career, but he did not want to overdwell on the Beatles side of things. So he's resisted all attempts to kind of tempt him out to talk only about the Beatles, because it was a part of his life. And he set it down on paper, but he hasn't done much with it since. He was an observer, he was a writer, and he was a photographer. And then when it all finished, he went on and had the rest of his life. And he knows I'd like to interview him. And what we've done instead is have lots of emails. We had a flurry. of emails. We'll probably do more at some point. If he leaves nothing else, he's left us in the Beatles world. He's left us with the longest cocktail party, which is a tremendous contribution. The original British edition fell apart when you opened it. It was a bit like the Beatles Get Back book that came with the Let It Be album. As soon as you opened it, it split. And so I've got three or four editions of that book just to kind of have one that isn't falling apart. A brilliant book. And he kept in touch with Derek, of course, as did most people who had known Derek, because he was the kind of guy you'd want to keep in touch with. The next one I'm going to mention is this album size, this 12-inch square called The Beatles and Illustrated Record by Roy Carr and Tony Tyler. This book seemed to come out of nowhere. I was in the Claude Gill bookshop just behind Selfridges in 1975. In those days, no pop music sections in bookstores, I don't, as I recall it, but it was a big book and it stuck out. And I said, what's that? And what an extraordinary book this is, because it's, first of all, it's written by two music enthusiasts. So it's from the musical point of view, and it reviews all the singles and albums that had come out from 1961 or 62 with My Bonnie and Love Me Do up to the time of printing, which I think was in the first edition, it might have been Extra Texture or thereabouts, about 75. They both wrote for the New Musical Express. They both knew what they were talking about. They both had strong opinions. It was highly illustrated. It's called an illustrated record. There's a lot of pictures in this book I'd never seen before. A lot of old advertisements from the newspapers that I'd never seen. It was a formative book in every way. And in terms of forming one's knowledge, they were less enthusiastic about the Beatles' solo work. George, I know, didn't like what they wrote about his stuff. I don't think Paul was a great fan of what they wrote about some of the Wings albums, but Paul was still okay with Roy Carr as a person. And Roy Carr was an extraordinary man. I mean, I didn't get to know Tony Tyler, but I did get to know Roy Carr, and he really was a player, not just a journalist, but actively involved in all sorts of things. They were entitled to their opinions because they'd been there and lived it and done it. John Lennon evidently got the book and enjoyed it because he typed them one of his characteristic notes about something that they got wrong, and they included that. They reproduced it facsimile in the second edition of the book, which was an update. The book got updated two or three times, I think, up to the early 1980s. And then they did a Rolling Stones book like this, and I think a Bowie one. I've got the Stones one anyway, which is also a brilliant book. Some of their opinions became embedded as facts. For example, the Beatles look a bit bored and they're a bit tired when they did the Beatles for Sale album. That became the way that album would go down. This is the album where they look a bit bored and a bit tired and they're a bit jaded, and they need to bounce back from this kind of thing. I swear that point of view only exists because Roy Carr and Tony Tyler said it. I myself am guilty of repeating it. I don't hold that view so much anymore, but I know where it came from. And that was the power of the writers of the books in those days to actually, wittingly or unwittingly, to set the agenda or the way that things would be received. It was in black and white in a book. And if you were enthusiastic about this subject, there weren't many books to devour. And so a lot of fans from those days have the shared experience of devouring this book. There aren't books now that every fan has devoured because there are so many. Have you read this one? No. Have you read that one? No, I've got it, but I haven't read it, and so on and so on. Generally speaking, I think the days of everyone looking at a certain book are over. So that was a great influence, Roy Carr and Tony Tyler. They were the ones who said that Let Me Roll It was a tip of the hat to John Lennon. And everyone said that after that. I don't think it was in Paul's mind when he was doing it. Maybe someone can point out to me that he said that he was, but I don't think so. But because Roy Carr and Tony Tyler said it, others repeated it, and it just became part of the fabric. And the fifth and final one, which is an edited compilation of pages from Merseybeat newspaper as edited by Bill Harry. And I think what Bill did was gave a stack of issues to Omnibus Press and the designer Pierce Marchbank, cobbled together this brilliant book of facsimile articles, slightly altering history in that it looks like certain things were next to one another on the original page and they weren't. So, for example, the very first thing you see is the front page of the first issue of Merseybeat. And John Lennon's article being a short diversion on the dubious origins of Beatles, you know, but the one about Flaming Pie and all of that, Beatles with an A, appears to be on the front page of Merseybeat, and it got written that way from thereafter. But if you actually see the original issue, it's not on the front page, it's on the second page.
Mm.
So apart from that slight skewing, it was an opportunity to see inside the pages of Merseybeat, which I never had before. I now have a complete set of them, or a set of copies of them, originals and copies. But in 1977, when this book came out, I'd never seen any pages of Merseybeat. And it was an absolute education into the Beatles at New Brighton Tower and the Cavern and Litherland Town Hall and Aintree Institute and all these kind of places that had an importance in the story from being written about. But I had never seen the advertisements, and I didn't have the dates of them playing there. So there was a great education into the Beatles' formative years in particular. Merseybeat in itself, I now know, is not the whole story, but it was very important. And this was an opportunity to see inside it for the first time. So a wonderful contribution that Bill Harry made there, and that Omnibus Press made by having the book of it.
Mm.
Because I'm passionate about these books, I've gone on to know the authors and something of the history of the publication, and those kind of nuts and bolts interest me a lot. So if I am missing out anything important, I will probably be offending the author as well. Sorry about that.
Sorry, monks. just to draw ourselves vaguely toward a conclusion, I want to talk just a little bit about kind of more semi-official titles that come out, which hopefully you can offer a little bit of insight into. I want to talk a bit about George Harrison's I, Me, Mine book.
Yeah.
I'm sure most listeners will know is a sort of autobiography, which was initially published by Genesis Publications in 1980. Very, very limited run initially, and then got a much wider release. You mentioned Brian Roylance in our last conversation, who was the main man at Genesis. Obviously, you knew Derek quite well. It's quite an interesting idea, really, this book, because George, not the most publicity-happy person ever, and certainly not at this point. Can you kind of give us any idea or insight as to why and how this book came about?
Yes, it came about because Brian Roylance and Derek Taylor knew one another. Genesis Publications were a publisher of beautiful, hand-tooled, expensive, but very, very fine books. Obviously, there are many kinds of books, and there is a niche market for very beautiful, ornate, limited edition, numbered editions, folios, and they have been for a very long time. And Brian had set up a company, Genesis Publications, that did them, and they published Captain Bligh's log of the HMS Bounty. Brian Roylance got to know Derek Taylor, and it came up in conversation that George might be interested in seeing this book or something like that. So they met. Derek said, I'll introduce you to George. And they met. Brian proposed that George might want to be involved in a book like this. What did he have that could be produced in this beautiful fashion where letters look like they're still on the original paper? They're not just quoted in a book, you actually get a leaf in the book that is like the facsimile of the letter, with the same kind of paper and the weight of the paper and the color of the paper and so on. And George had his handwritten lyrics. They decided they would do a book of it. It coincided with George seeing on television a program that your older listeners might know called Out of Town, which was made by Southern Television and had a very nice, charming old gent, bearded gent with a pipe, Jack Hargreaves, who was very interested in taking the viewer to places around Britain where people still did things the old-fashioned way. And I think he did a program about binding, something like that. Let me look at what George actually wrote, because he does say something of this in the front.
Okay.
Jack Hargreaves' program, Out of Town, was on television. He showed how old leather books could be restored to their original condition, which made me appreciate the craft and seriously consider having these trivial bits of paper dignified in this way. So they decided they would collaborate on this book. And Derek was the bridge between George and Brian. Derek was obviously someone that George was very close to. And since it needed words, in addition to the facsimile lyrics, it was agreed that Derek would interview George for the book and write the piece in the first person. But it was going to be strictly limited edition. I think the subscription price, the offer price was £148. And then when it actually was finished and on sale, only on sale by mail order, of course, not in any shops, it was £175. Well, that is quite a lot of money still. And in 1979-80, when it was being advertised, it was scandalously expensive. And everybody took a lot of flack because George's principal readership, his fan base, which was diminishing anyway, people like me who, you know, was on a regular wage somewhere, and I might pay whatever I paid Roy Carr and Tony Tyler's book, you know, something 95, you know, 7.95 or something like that. Suddenly this was 148 or £175 and beyond my affordability. So there was a lot of criticism of that. And then a criticism a second time when it came out as a mainstream edition a couple of years later through W.H. Allen, because that annoyed all the people who had paid out a lot of money for the original edition, who said, oh, I wouldn't have bought it if I'd known you were going to do a cheap one. But the original has maintained and appreciated in value. George did sign every single copy of the book. They are numbered and they are beautiful. And Genesis Publications have been working on such books ever since and still are.
Do you think it's a successful book?
Yeah, certainly. And another major contribution to our knowledge, because it was great to see George's original scraps of paper and to have a little bit about the writing of each song. Sometimes you would wish for more, or that he had changed the subject a little bit and been asked about particular lines necessarily. But nonetheless, George said, what about Derek said, what about this song? And George would give a paragraph or two about that song. And that's all very insightful. It made me realize for a start how quite a lot of George's songs released in the 70s were actually throwbacks to the 60s that he hadn't used yet. I was quite surprised about that. I knew Not Guilty was, but I didn't realise quite a few others were as well. The text was the text that Derek typed based on his interviews with George. And that caused some issue, particularly with John, because he barely mentioned John and didn't mention John much either when he was writing about or talking about the making of the writing of each song. So John got very miffed. And that was something that, because it was fresh, it came up in the interview that he did with Playboy.
Mm.
Maybe even more than one interview in that Double Fantasy little interview period that John had there. How miffed he was with George because he barely gets a mention in his book because he felt he deserved a bigger mention than he got. But the book did very well, and George ended up doing quite a few other things. Olivia still does work with Genesis. Derek's 50 Years Adrift came out. And that's why 50 Years Adrift has never come out in any other edition, because they were well aware that unrest had been caused by I Me Mine suddenly coming out in a cheaper edition, a mainstream edition. They made it absolutely clear, if you buy this book, it won't come out in any other form. And they've kind of stuck to that, even though it's frustrating that 50 Years Adrift is not better known.
Mm, absolutely. Maybe the last book we'll talk about, and I'll be intrigued to get your view and your insight on this, because as most of us will know, you were involved with the Beatles Anthology Project. There was a book that came out, although it didn't come out at the time of all the other anthology effects. It came out in the year 2000. I suppose the first question here is, did you have any kind of involvement in the production of that book at all?
In a small way, yes. I was involved in other aspects of the anthology quite significantly, but the book, no, not really. It was going to be a Genesis publication, but I think for the mainstream, but I think because Brian was very much a trusted publisher, Brian Roylance, he was going to be the one who collated it and did for a while, but ultimately it didn't happen with Genesis, and it went to, I think, Cassell in the UK. I'm not sure. Chronicle in the US?
Chronicle.
It was designed by David Costa, who was known and liked by everybody. And George knew him and used him to design some things for him. And he was strong with Elton John, David Costa, and had worked for Elton for years. And so I went at someone's request, and it might have even been Brian Roylance. I went into David Costa's studio in London for about a week in 98-ish, 99, and read the entire book for anything that might be wrong. These were the Beatles' own words, so you couldn't just go correcting them, but they were aware that if the book had obvious errors in it, either in terms of captions or information said by a Beatle that was very wrong, that I would at least point it out. And then they would be aware, and then they could either make the change or leave it, depending on sensitivities and so on. You don't easily correct a Beatle. There is a tendency to leave whatever they remember wrong, wrong. But nonetheless, I think they wanted it pointed out to them where it might get criticised, if it was going to be criticised, or indeed where things could be changed safely. And so I had that involvement in it, and I went and read it a couple of years before publication, and did do a report about things that could be improved within it. But otherwise, I didn't have any involvement. The core of it was the interviews they'd done for the anthology. But that wasn't all, and they did supplement that with a lot of other interviews as well, some of which I provided to them. And the John in particular, of course, because he hadn't been interviewed for the anthology, anything that Apple ever do, they're very acutely aware of balance. So they had to get John in there as much as possible. So they were really scrabbling around for anything John had said, because obviously George and Paul and Ringo could elaborate at great length on things. So for John, they ransacked Lennon Remembers and the Playboy interviews. And John's interviews, they don't have the perspective that the other interviews have, where they're talking from the 90s, looking back at events. John's interview is always much more immediate and shorter. But anyway, they got him in there. And that is their own story, and we'll never have a book like it. We've got Paul doing bits. We've got we had George doing bits. That book is incredible.
There's a scene in, there's a fascinating little clip in the George Harrison Living in the Material World film where there's the three, obviously from the anthology time, the three of them, and they're flicking through what looks like the anthology book in that video. It would have made more sense, I always thought, for it to come out with everything else. Do you know if there was a deliberate attempt to delay it, or was it like a publishing issue?
There will be a file in Apple that has all the answers to that question, those questions. And I don't have access to that file. I'd love to know. My own recollection, getting the anthology out, which was the TV series that eventually became VHS and then DVD in extended form, getting though everything approved, getting everyone to sign off on everything, and the albums and the deals that were done, particularly for the TV series, was all such an almighty job for Apple, which basically meant for Neil Aspinall at that time. They got out what they needed to get out. That was like, let's get the TV series on screen, let's get the records out. And it was like, oh, we'll think about the book later. It was never going to appear at the same time, because it was just impossible to do all those things simultaneously. And once the anthology was done, it had an after effect that everyone recoiled for a while, because they'd all Beatles too much. We just want more, but these people, it's their lives. And George, post-anthology, was like, you know, I don't want to talk about the Beatles again. You know, I've done it now. Well, there is this book, George. I'll piss off about the book, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm making that up. I'm not actually saying he said that, but it would be that kind of thing. And then there were other issues as well of a kind, and I'm not going to elaborate on that, about the nuts and bolts of how it all came together. So it took its time. Eventually came out quite a period of time after, a bit like the Wingspan book came out quite a period of time after the TV show that it was meant to accompany. It's just one of those things. You just can't do everything at once.
It's interesting you were talking about anthology there, about the fact they were beetled out, where if you think about, even now, if you get any kind of project like that from any act, you will get junk interviews, you'll get magazine interviews, you'll get someone on Graham Norton or Jimmy Fallon or whatever. But if you look at that time, George Harrison in 1995 does one interview around the time of the anthology, which is in Australia. Ringo does one appearance, I think, on Good Morning America. And Paul does one Christmas interview where he does an interview at home in the snow. And obviously, Paul's had Linda's illness around that time, so that might have stopped him from doing more promotional stuff. But if you think about now, it's amazing that they didn't do more. But I suppose, as you say, everyone must have been a bit beetled out at that point.
They were Beatled out. They did do interviews with Laura Gross for the EPKs. The EPKs were really important in those days because they knew that if they did one interview with Laura, who was very good at making these packages, Apple would own it, but they would feed it out to NBC, CBS, ABC, BBC, ITV, whoever, any news program in any country. And that would save, it was a bit like the early days of making a promo video. You did it so you didn't have to go on TV and talk about it in person. Well, her interviews were quite widely broadcast. But in terms of devoted interviews with particular stations or channels, it's interesting that you point out they did one each. Balance is everything. Paul could not go and do five because George wasn't going to do five, and nor was Ringo, and therefore Paul couldn't, because they were acutely aware of balance. Otherwise, it looks like Paul's talking about it more than the others, and that those are the sensitivities that they were all extremely mindful of, still are, but particularly then, where we had three Beatles alive instead of two. The politics of all these things is really quite extraordinary, and you're quite astute to have noticed that they only did, if you, as you say, one each. It's like, yeah, if I knew that, I'd forgotten, but that will be the reason.
Fascinating. Well, Mark, it's been a wonderful trip through Beatles books and their impact on you and on the wider Beatle kind of world. So it just leaves me to say thank you again so much for your time in talking to me.
You're very welcome. It's great that there is a podcast devoted to Beatles books. There are a lot of books, there are a lot of authors. There's a lot to talk about. And especially these days, with a lot of books being niche. You know, just a book about Dark Horse Records, just a book about Apple, and so on, then those authors are naturally going to be diving quite deeply. And so there's always good stuff to be said. I'm glad you're doing what you do.
Pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you.